candidates from each of the three services, and Taylor tallied the score. The winner was Air Force General Jacob E. Smart. Admiral McDonnell was dismayed that a command that had always been under Navy control, in the Navy's most important traditional theater of operations, might shift to another service. He was especially astonished that, given their traditional partnership, the Commandant of the Marine Corps voted against him in this matter of great importance to him and the Department of the Navy. Green felt that General Smart was the best man for the job. Admiral McDonald and General Green exchanged bitter words over the phone immediately after the meeting. McDonald threatened to repay Green in kind on issues important to the Marine Corps. The controversy between Green and McDonald created a lasting and deeply felt animosity between them. After he talked to Green, McDonald went directly to McNamara's office to plead his case. McNamara listened, and on the same day, supported McDonald by selecting Admiral Ulysses S. Olley Sharp for the post. But McNamara's intervention on behalf of the Navy had a price. McDonald, who had hitherto opposed McNamara's plans, no longer objected to them outside of JCS meetings. Each chief's desire to further his own services agenda hampered their collective ability to provide military advice. After gaining McNamara's support in the Commander-in-Chief Pacific, or SINCPAC, dispute, McDonald felt indebted to him. McDonald had regarded the SINCPAC issue as a test of his mettle, and he was striving to protect his credibility with officers and sailors of the Navy. Losing SINCPAC might have caused the Navy to lose faith in its chief of naval operations. McDonald also felt himself indebted to civilian officials in the Pentagon for instituting a new policy that allowed the wife of every naval officer who attains the rank of 3 stars or more to christen a United States Navy ship. The controversy over the SINCPAC replacement explained why Admiral McDonald voiced his dislike of McNamara's plan in JCS meetings, but balked at the opportunity to bring his objections forward to the Secretary of Defense or the President. The Admiral was a pragmatist who believed that an officer who rises to high rank must be guided by the conditions that exist at that particular time. McNamara's patronage made McDonald obligated to the Secretary of Defense for his support on matters that the Admiral regarded as vital to the morale of the Navy. McDonald's preoccupation with furthering the interests of his service impelled him to make concessions in what he regarded as less important areas to gain support, or at least acquiescence, on more vital issues. The chiefs desperately needed a leader to bring them together. Only the chairman could overcome their profound preoccupation with service interests. But Taylor, anxious to keep competing advice from the president, resolved to use the chief's divisions to keep the policy-making initiative with McNamara and himself. Unable to work together in a productive manner, and with their advice silenced by the Secretary of Defense and the chairman, the chiefs did not challenge McNamara's strategic concept for American military involvement in Vietnam. The president, distrustful of his military advisors and preoccupied with achieving unity in his administration, sought to keep the chiefs from opposing his Vietnam policy. Uninterested in the chief's advice, but unwilling to risk their disaffection, Johnson preserved a facade of consultation, concealed the finality of his decisions on Vietnam policy, and promised that more forceful actions against the North might be taken in the future. Preoccupied with the election and committed to taking only the minimum action necessary to keep South Vietnam from going communist, he depended on McNamara and Taylor to provide him with advice consistent with that overwhelming priority. The president got the military advice he wanted. McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure seemed to solve the president's problem of not losing Vietnam while maintaining the image that he was reluctant to escalate the war. If the chiefs had successfully pressed with the president their position that the United States needed to act forcefully to defeat the North, they might have forced a difficult choice between war and withdrawal from South Vietnam. Through their own actions, as well as through the manipulation of Taylor and McNamara, the Chiefs missed their opportunity to influence the formulation of a strategic concept for Vietnam, and thereafter always found themselves in the difficult position of questioning a policy that the president had already approved. The intellectual foundation for deepening American involvement in Vietnam had been laid without the participation of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Chapter 5. From Distrust to Deceit, March to July, 1964. I don't object to it being called McNamara's War. I think it is a very important war, and I am pleased to be identified with it and do whatever I can to win it. Robert S. McNamara, 1964. He who permits himself to tell a lie often finds it much easier to do it a second and third time, till at length it becomes habitual. He tells lies without attending to it, and truths without the world's believing him. This falsehood of the tongue leads to that of the heart, and in time depraves all its good dispositions. Thomas Jefferson, 1785. At the end of March, after the president had approved McNamara's strategy of graduated pressure, discontent within the Joint Chiefs of Staff bubbled to the surface. Suspecting that Taylor had misrepresented their views to the president, McDonald, Green, and LeMay, on separate occasions, confidentially contacted the president's military aide, General Clifton. Clifton briefed the president on the information the chiefs had given him, telling Johnson that he sensed a potentially difficult and even dangerous situation in the Joint Chiefs of Staff in connection with the McNamara plan of action for Vietnam. Although Clifton acknowledged that the chiefs were badly split on what action to take, he explained that they agreed on the minimum measures that were necessary to improve the situation in South Vietnam. Unlike McNamara and Taylor, they did not think that political stability in South Vietnam was a prerequisite for attacking the North. LeMay and Green, saying that the French had failed to secure Vietnam with 500,000 men, believed that limited American military activities would be useless and urged that the war be expanded into the North. Because the first covert operations under Op Plan 34A had been a dismal failure, the chiefs recommended sending American aircraft to bomb the Petroleum Supply Center in North Vietnam. They argued that it was necessary to cut off supply lines in Laos and Cambodia and to pursue the Viet Cong across those borders. The chiefs expressed doubt that the present holding action would be sufficient and warned that the policy could lead to a major foreign policy failure. Appealing to the president's concerns about the election, Clifton reported that the chiefs called the graduated pressure policy the Asian Bay of Pigs and were carefully recording their dissent so that this time they could not be blamed in case of a disaster. He warned the president that LeMay's scheduled retirement presented an inherent danger for the president because the general will be tempted to speak out on this matter, especially when he feels that so much more should be done against the North Vietnamese sanctuary, and especially when he feels that this proposition hasn't been reviewed thoroughly and that all the chiefs haven't had a chance to speak on the matter. Clifton explained that LeMay, like any military professional, would not publicly challenge the policies of the government lest he undermine civil control over the military. Once LeMay retired, however, the professional military ethic would no longer bind him and he would feel free to speak out against the administration. Clifton also warned Johnson about potential political threats from Ambassador Lodge and General Harkins. The chiefs felt that Harkins was being made a patsy and might speak out after retirement about his troubled relations with the ambassador. They believed that Lodge, who had not fully supported the hold-until-November strategy, might return to campaign against the president on the basis of Vietnam policy. According to Clifton, the chiefs felt that Westmoreland had a malleable personality and would fare no better than Harkins. The general offered a number of solutions to this messy situation. He recommended that Johnson send a copy of the McNamara paper to each of the chiefs to solicit their individual views on it, as well as to Ambassador Lodge and General Harkins to get them signed on. To determine the feasibility of holding on until November, Clifton advised that Johnson demand from the chiefs two estimates of the situation, one to determine the possibilities of success or failure before the election, and the other, a long-range analysis based on the assumption that there would be no crisis before November. Clifton suggested that Johnson assign someone tougher than Westmoreland to Military Assistance Command Vietnam, and suggested that Harkins might be kept silent by reassigning him to another post or by offering him an ambassadorship. Clifton urged the president to meet informally with the chiefs and invite them to bring their suggestions directly to his attention. The implications of Clifton's memo forced Johnson to define his relationship with his top military advisors more precisely. He did not, however, honestly seek advice from the JCS, as Clifton had suggested, but rather solicited their opinions on aspects of Vietnam policy without intending to heed them, so that they would not voice their disagreement publicly. Most of all, Johnson held open the option of more determined military actions to co-opt his military advisors, as Forrestal had recommended. The president, who desired unity and feared dissent, instinctively treated his military advisors as a potential source of political opposition. Although his principal concern was the November election, he was unwilling to tell the chiefs that he was basing his Vietnam decisions on his campaign strategy rather than on military considerations and foreign policy concerns. The first problem that LBJ would tackle was what to do about General Curtis LeMay, whom Air Force Secretary Eugene Zuckert described as a thorn in the administration's side. While considering the general's reappointment in January 1964, Johnson asked outgoing Deputy Secretary of Defense Gilpatrick to advise him about LeMay. Gilpatrick, a New York attorney who had previously served as Undersecretary of the Air Force in the Truman administration, thought that LeMay just wasn't cut out to be in the role of principal military advisor and regretted that he was not a strategist and thinker like General Taylor. He recommended that some kind of mission be found for LeMay to keep him occupied and not making statements to the press, such as an inspection tour of U.S. and Allied air bases overseas. On January 28th, Clifton suggested that LeMay might not be interested in the assignment and recommended instead that he serve as the president's consultant on the supersonic transport. General Taylor, eager to find a more pliant officer to serve as Air Force chief, began to consider whom to recommend as LeMay's replacement and solicited General Lemnitzer's opinion of General John P. McConnell. In early spring, LeMay learned from Zuckert that McNamara was not recommending his reappointment because he could not get along with civilian officials in the Department of Defense. LeMay responded cavalierly, "I didn't expect anything different. What's your problem?" However, the president's talk with Clifton at the end of March forced him to reconsider the LeMay problem. On April 3rd, LeMay attended a cocktail reception at the White House, at which President Johnson asked the general about his post-retirement plans. The president, perhaps remembering how Kennedy had removed Admiral Anderson, offered LeMay an ambassadorship. When LeMay told the president that he was not interested in such a position, Johnson asked LeMay to give him about 10 days to make him another offer. 4 days later, the president informed LeMay that he would reappoint him as Air Force Chief of Staff for another year. Johnson knew that LeMay, who believed that civilian control of the military is essential to a democracy, would not publicly oppose the administration's policy as long as he remained in uniform. Johnson, meanwhile, drew his advisory circle even tighter as the election approached. He met with his closest advisors every Tuesday for lunch. The principal participants in this advisory and decision-making forum were Rusk, McGeorge Bundy, and McNamara. Beginning in 1964, these Tuesday lunches became councils in which the president discussed both foreign and domestic policy. The first luncheon was held on February 4th, just 11 weeks after Johnson became president. 20 more were held in the spring and summer of 1964. According to Walt Rostow, Tuesday lunches were the heart of the national security process, and the only men present were those whose advice the president most wanted to hear. The agenda often included Vietnam and the election campaign together. No military officer, not even Taylor, was a regular member of this select group. The luncheon forum was designed to achieve consensus on major policy issues and, by its exclusivity, to prevent leaks of those discussions to Congress or the press. White House Special Assistant Forrestal recalled, "There was a bad thing in this period. The government was extremely scared of itself. There was tremendous nervousness that if you expressed an opinion, it might somehow leak out, and the president would be furious and everyone's head would be cut off. It inhibited an exchange of information and prevented the president himself from getting a lot of the facts that he should have had." The advisors' desire to demonstrate unity inspired them to coordinate their positions before discussing them with Johnson. Rusk recalled that the president disliked the role of refereeing among senior colleagues, wanted his senior advisors to come to conclusions that they themselves would reach if they were president. Rusk's previous experience in the Truman administration as liaison between the often opposed Secretary of State Dean Acheson and Secretary of Defense Lewis Johnson convinced him that the two cabinet officials with primary responsibility for foreign affairs should harmonize their positions. According to Rusk, he and McNamara almost never went to the president with a divided opinion. We took it upon ourselves to make a special effort to reach a common conclusion. The men encouraged close contact between both departments at all levels. According to Walt Rostow, Bundy, McNamara, and Rusk regarded themselves as kind of a family. McNamara was the most assertive of the president's personal advisors, and his positions on the war dominated the discussions. The Tuesday lunches further isolated the JCS from the planning and decision-making process. Because the advice that Johnson received represented a coordinated position between the Secretaries of State and Defense, it was unlikely that the president or other civilian advisors would question it. The president remained ignorant of the chief's opinions, and the chiefs remained ill-informed of the direction in which the administration's Vietnam policy was headed. Because they were dissatisfied with McNamara's March report advocating graduated pressure, the JCS decided to organize a war game to test the assumptions that underlay this strategy. Between April 6th and 9th, the War Games Division of the Joint Chiefs of Staff conducted Sigma-1-64 to examine what might be produced if the Republic of Vietnam and the United States undertook a program of gradually increasing pressures against North Vietnam. Military officers assigned political and military roles and played the United States, North Vietnam, and such third countries as China and the Soviet Union. The outcome of the game was eerily prophetic. In response to U.S. military action, North Vietnam and the Viet Cong raised the tempo of attacks in the South and conducted terrorist attacks on U.S. installations and personnel. The game's final report concluded that a small expenditure of iron bombs led the United States to commit sizable forces and funds to defeat the North, while the war in the South continued with less attention and fewer resources. The paper warned that the U.S. public and Congress would not support a strategy based on graduated pressure. In fact, the officers who played the role of the North Vietnamese leaders in the game banked on a lack of American resolve to see their effort to fruition. The vast majority of the participants voiced grave doubts that air power would end North Vietnamese support for the Viet Cong. The game exposed fundamental flaws in the assumptions that underlay graduated pressure. First, it showed that North Vietnam was capable of responding to U.S. escalation by intensifying the war on the ground. Second, it suggested that the United States was underestimating Hanoi's resolve. The participants thought there were two solutions to these perplexing problems: withdrawing from Vietnam or doing enough the first time to convince North Vietnam that we really mean business. The test found that graduated pressure would lead to a protracted military commitment with little hope of success, as LeMay had originally predicted. One of the participants' remarks captured the frustration of those trying to draw conclusions from the outcome of the game. "If we back off like this looks like we should, we've lost Vietnam. We've got to use some other type of tactics, and my suggestion is that we've got to make it expensive for somebody to take on these excursions." The Sigma-1 test revealed the military and political difficulties associated with the application of graduated pressure to the war in Vietnam. Johnson, who had blocked the avenues by which he might obtain the chief's advice, never received the results of the Pentagon war game. McNamara was moving to sever all channels of communication between the JCS and the president. He shut off the back-channel communication between the JCS and Brigadier General Clifton. The defense secretary's position with the president depended on his control of information and advice on military matters, and he was determined to prevent the JCS from undermining his influence. All communications between the JCS and the White House went through his office. When, in early May, Clifton gave the president the chief's views on matters unrelated to Vietnam, such as cost-cutting initiatives in the services and employing women in uniform, McNamara became very disturbed about the route which General Clifton used in going to the several services directly. President Johnson supported McNamara and notified his staff that he wanted all military requests for appointments or decisions to come through the McNamara channel. McNamara sent to the president, however, only those assessments that supported his conception of prosecuting the conflict in Vietnam. Robert McNamara was not interested in the outcome of Sigma 1. He had seen his strategy for Vietnam approved without effective opposition and had available other methods for gathering and analyzing information. Political scientist Alexander George has observed that people tend to place more reliance on concrete information than abstract information in making predictions. Indeed, the Sigma test, largely a subjective evaluation based on military experience and diplomatic expertise, did not appeal to McNamara's penchant for systematic and quantitative analysis. McNamara used line charts to depict change over time in the counterinsurgency effort in Vietnam. He tracked the numbers of people killed on both sides, the rate of Viet Cong activity, weapons captured, number of aircraft sorties, North Vietnamese naval activity, the percent of South Vietnamese river boats on patrol, and the number of patrol days for South Vietnamese units. He used his team of systems analysts to help him determine the meaning of this data. Elaine Entevin, chief of the Systems Analysis Division, had broad responsibilities in the Department of Defense and believed that he could apply his analytical approach successfully to military operations. Entevin argued that it would be suicidal for the Secretary of Defense to forego quantitative analysis when considering the feasibility of his program for Vietnam. McNamara did use such techniques and thought that his quantitative indices indicated progress. Because his principal sources of information lay with Entevin and other civilians in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, McNamara spent less time consulting with the JCS. Lieutenant General Buse, General Greene's operations deputy, recalled that although McNamara met with the chiefs every Monday in 1963, he met with them less frequently in 1964. Roswell Gilpatrick, McNamara's deputy, often attended JCS meetings in McNamara's stead. Eventually, neither McNamara nor his deputy attended. Buse assumed that McNamara did all his business with Taylor. To Admiral McDonald, it seemed that when the secretary did attend, he really didn't expect to accomplish anything and came down just to show his face. Lieutenant General Harold K. Johnson, who attended the meetings as operations deputy to General Wheeler, regarded the infrequent encounters with McNamara as a cosmetic designed to guard against criticism that there was not a relationship between the civilian bosses and military leaders. General Johnson likened conferring with McNamara to a mating dance of the turkeys in which participants went through certain set procedures but solved no problems. In the beginning of April, the Joint Chiefs of Staff complained that they did not have political guidance sufficient to develop plans in support of graduated pressure. White House Special Assistant Michael Forrestal wanted to pacify the JCS, so he forwarded a list of planned diplomatic maneuvers and domestic political initiatives to the chiefs. Although McNamara was fixed on sharply limiting strikes against North Vietnam, the scenario promised to consider making the initial U.S. action strong. Included among the military options were the mining and naval bombardment of North Vietnamese ports and sustained airstrikes against North Vietnamese supply depots, training sites, and petroleum reserves. Yet Forrestal, who knew that the president would never authorize anything like the actions proposed in the political scenario, deliberately misled the JCS because he knew that the promise of future actions and the impression that the administration would consider using a hard knock against North Vietnam would keep the chiefs content for a while. Forrestal and McNaughton, who had recently taken over for William Bundy as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Affairs, cautioning that more perceptive people at the Pentagon might suspect the White House staff of putting up a straw man, persuaded McNamara to put it to the chiefs officially to stop growing criticism that no formal political proposal has been made to them. The political scenario on which the chiefs based their first in-depth planning for escalation of the military effort in Vietnam assumed that the United States might take actions that the Johnson administration would resist taking during its entire tenure in office. By deceiving the chiefs, civilians in the White House and Defense Department forestalled debate on the nature of the U.S. commitment in Vietnam and perpetuated misconceptions concerning the level of force that the commitment was likely to require. In April, the JCS used Forrestal's political scenario to develop a list of military actions for McNaughton. The latter, in coordination with Forrestal and William Sullivan, the Secretary of State's Special Assistant for Vietnamese Affairs, then developed political and military scenarios for the gradual escalation of U.S. intervention in Vietnam, assuming that the situation in the South would deteriorate further and that the North would take certain actions. The scenarios listed political and military actions that the American government might take to bolster the counterinsurgency effort in the South or to respond to aggression from the North. Despite their doubts about McNamara's strategic concept, the chiefs were thus obliged to plan military actions in support of graduated pressure. On April 17th, the JCS forwarded to McNamara Op Plan 37-64, which identified military targets for a campaign of graduated overt pressures against North Vietnam. It was a three-phase plan, covering operations against VC infiltration routes in Laos and Cambodia and against targets in North Vietnam. Phase 1 provided for air and ground strikes within South Vietnam and permitted hot pursuit of enemy forces into the border regions of Laos and Cambodia. Phase 2 detailed tit-for-tat airstrikes, airborne and amphibious raids, and aerial mining operations against North Vietnamese targets. Phase 3 laid out a program for graduated overt pressure against North Vietnam in the form of increasingly severe airstrikes and other actions that went far beyond the tit-for-tat concept. The plan did not specify the degree of intensity with which American or South Vietnamese air forces would carry out the attacks. An annex attached to the op plan included a list of 91 targets in North Vietnam. In the next year, McNamara and the president would select targets from a revised version in order to retaliate against the North for attacks on U.S. forces and thus begin applying graduated pressure to North Vietnam. Although the chief suggested that, from a military viewpoint, it is considered that the most effective application of military force will result from a sudden, sharp blow, they had mainly developed a plan for gradually intensifying military actions. McNamara, ignoring that qualification, used the chief's document to plan his own program of graduated pressure against North Vietnam. Graduated pressure depended on the assumption that the limited application of force would compel the North Vietnamese to the negotiating table and exact from them a favorable diplomatic settlement. There was no need to pursue military victory because negotiations would achieve the same political objectives with only the threat of more severe military action. The only question was when, not if, the enemy would be induced to negotiate. On April 19th and 20th, Rusk, General Wheeler, and Assistant Secretary of State for Far Eastern Affairs, William Bundy, traveled to Saigon to discuss Op Plan 37-64 with Lodge. During that visit, Rusk supported Ambassador Lodge's suggestion that the United States make a diplomatic overture toward North Vietnam. On returning to the United States, he arranged for a Canadian official, J. Blair Seaborn, to deliver a warning to Hanoi that continued support for the insurgency in the South would result in great devastation to North Vietnam. The mission, the first of many attempts to couple the threat or use of force with diplomatic overtures to North Vietnam, failed. When he returned, Wheeler met with Taylor and the other chiefs, as well as the outgoing Commander-in-Chief Pacific, Admiral Felt. LeMay asked Felt what would be needed to win the war and whether action against the North would be necessary. Felt responded that to achieve victory, the United States would need a reasonably secure base in the South and would have to go north sometime. To prevent dissension among his advisors and the military, Johnson led the chiefs to believe that he was seriously considering expanding the military effort. The urgency with which the administration had encouraged JCS planning for military action in Vietnam, however, was inconsistent with his determination to constrain the level of commitment. Westmoreland recalled that officials in Saigon regarded Op Plan 37 as a post-election plan. When Wheeler asked the new Deputy Secretary of Defense, Cyrus Vance, whether there was a ceiling on forces in Vietnam, Vance replied that the military is fat out there and told Wheeler that he would only accept a validated requirement, one that could be justified quantitatively for additional forces. William Bundy later viewed the planning effort in the spring of 1964 as an emotional safety valve for those who might otherwise pressure the president into taking actions that he was determined to avoid. The planning efforts actually served the purpose of delaying genuine consideration of the situation in Vietnam until after the election, keeping the JCS busy and at the same time permitting LBJ to keep the war low-key. Despite the president's efforts, however, calls to undertake additional action mounted. In early May, Ambassador Lodge became convinced that action against the North was not only desirable, but necessary. He indicated that General Khan was also dissatisfied with the course of the war. Khan was prepared to declare a state of war between South and North Vietnam, impose martial law in the South, and issue an ultimatum to North Vietnam. He told Lodge that it was illogical, wasteful, and wrong to go on incurring casualties just in order to make the agony endure. The general urged moving ahead to get a real victory. Lodge, sympathizing, concluded, "This man obviously wants to get on with the job and not sit here indefinitely taking casualties. Who can blame him? He is clearly facing up to all the hard questions and wants us to do it too." As assessments of the situation in Vietnam were generally growing more pessimistic, the president again sent McNamara and Taylor to Saigon to defuse this latest challenge to the president's policy. Taylor found himself in the familiar role of defending the administration's policy against those who were anxious to fight the war in a less constrained fashion. He met with Harkins and the Military Assistance Command Vietnam, or MACV, staff on the morning of May 11th. Westmoreland, who would assume command of the American war effort in Vietnam, told Taylor that not only Khan, but many Vietnamese generals were pressing for attacks against North Vietnam. The staff officers at MACV pressed Taylor to lift restrictions on some of the South Vietnamese covert actions against North Vietnam that the United States had been supporting since the beginning of 1962. Operation Farmgate, for example, required that a South Vietnamese pilot accompany American pilots on their operations in order to preserve the pretense that the flights were training exercises. In practice, Farmgate pilots took along South Vietnamese observers to whom they referred as sandbags. When the Air Force commander in Vietnam, Major General Joseph H. Moore, spoke of the awkward arrangement, Taylor replied that the presence of South Vietnamese pilots would continue to be required. And when Moore, who had been Westmoreland's high school classmate, broached the possibility of introducing B-57s, or another squadron of A-1E aircraft into Vietnam, Taylor again rebuffed him. Taylor, also voicing dissatisfaction with the targeting of fuel storage facilities under Op Plan 34A, remarked that these missions might not be subtle enough to maintain plausible deniability. The Secretary of Defense joined the conference on May 12th and further emphasized the restrictions on American involvement in direct combat actions. He also stated that the U.S. Air Force pilots were never supposed to participate in combat. When General Westmoreland asked for additional Special Forces units, McNamara replied that when MACV put the requirement in writing, he would approve the request if he deemed it valid. He ordered the MACV officers to base their requests on quantitative data so his staff could test their validity. Indeed, McNamara was confident that he could calculate precisely the amount of force necessary to secure the administration's objectives in Vietnam. To do so, however, he would have to exert tight control over his military officers, something he believed had been facilitated by his reforms in the Pentagon. "We have been able to create and control the balanced, flexible forces now at our disposal, to harness this wide array of human and material resources, and to form them into usable power requires an exceedingly precise degree of control. The engine of defense must be so harnessed that its vast power may be unleashed to the precise degree required by whatever threat we face." McNamara's faith in graduated pressure rested on the principle of precise control of the application of force. As a corollary, he had to control the military precisely. McNamara also had to exercise close control over U.S. advisory forces already engaged in combat alongside the South Vietnamese Army, lest they compromise the president's election bid. Lieutenant General Krulak recalled that McNamara was under tremendous pressure from the president to cloak the military effort in South Vietnam until the November election. McNamara had learned from the Cuban Missile Crisis that political objectives do not disappear when we begin to exercise military power. Indeed, they are all the more seriously to be considered, for with the initiation of force, we move into the zone in which errors may be irrevocable. Accordingly, he thought that control over military forces must be held firmly in the hands of the man preeminently responsible for national security, that is, in the hands of the president. McNamara was trying to preserve that control by emphasizing, rather than removing, restrictions on military actions. The May meeting in Saigon was characteristic of the relationship between McNamara and the military. Neither side was forthright. The military tried gradually to erode barriers to further action, while McNamara, suspicious of the military's behavior and eager to avoid increasing the troop strength in Vietnam, was determined to make the generals justify every request quantitatively, in writing. The Secretary of Defense was careful, however, not to alienate the military officers completely. Requests that had the potential of becoming politically volatile, if not accepted, gained easy approval. Accordingly, McNamara told the senior MACV officers to ask for anything they needed and promised that winning the war in South Vietnam was his top priority. He continued to conceal from the military the limitations on the level of effort the president was willing to approve. The Secretary of Defense and General Taylor returned to Washington amid rising criticism of U.S. policy in the press. A May 13th editorial in the Wall Street Journal, entitled "Error Upon Error," observed that it is almost impossible to figure out what is the U.S. strategy, and declared that the evidence indicates the lack of any plan. On May 15th, perhaps to forestall further criticism, President Johnson canceled the scheduled agenda for the noontime National Security Council meeting. Instead, he invited congressional leaders of both parties to hear briefings from Rusk and McNamara. Taylor represented the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The discussion turned quickly to Vietnam, and the president asked the general for his assessment. Although the chiefs had been pressing for action against the North, Taylor told the legislators, "If we attack North Vietnam, there would be a strong reaction by the Viet Cong in the South. The larger the U.S. attack, the greater chance of communist reaction." Taylor lent his support to McNamara's gradual approach to bombing, should it be undertaken. He argued that restraint would be necessary because the level of the attack would be the determining factor in the communist reaction. Although he had just received a briefing to the contrary, Secretary McNamara helped the president's cause further by claiming that U.S. soldiers are not engaged in combat except in the course of their training the Vietnamese. The bulk of the air effort is by South Vietnamese forces and does not involve exposing our men. On May 19th, journalist Douglas Cader arrived at the White House for his first day on the job as an assistant to the president. McGeorge Bundy had not yet decided what duties to assign Cader, and the former National Security Affairs editor for The Reporter magazine spent a boring time in the White House Situation Room. Later, former Secretary of State Dean Acheson telephoned Cader to invite him to his Georgetown home for cocktails. Cader, who had accomplished nothing that day, thought, perhaps this is the way it works. That evening, Acheson gave the White House aide a message that was obviously meant for President Johnson. He told Cader, "Things are going to hell in a hack in Vietnam, and if the president does not do something that relates to getting the support of Congress in a Formosa-type resolution, it's going to be too late, and we'll go into this orgasm of a campaign period in which things will just have to stall." Cader hurried back to the White House, composed his first White House memo, and slipped it into the president's night reading. The next day, in response to Cader's memo and intensified attacks by the Pathet Lao guerrillas in Laos, President Johnson ordered McGeorge Bundy to look into the Vietnam problem with renewed vigor. On May 22nd, Bundy reported that four working groups were pulling together military and political plans to address the situation. The first group, under John McNaughton, developed a military plan based on the premise that actions would be designed to hurt but not to destroy. He hoped that such limited action would convince the North Vietnamese to desist from their support of the Viet Cong. The second group, under William Sullivan, recommended a vast expansion of the American military and civilian effort to put a tall American at every point of the stress and strain. The third group, under NSC staff member Chester Cooper, analyzed possible enemy reactions to U.S. moves. The fourth, led by Undersecretary of State George Ball, drafted several congressional resolutions to give the president a full range of choice in seeking congressional validation of military action. Even though the subjects of three of the four groups clearly had military implications, the Joint Chiefs found themselves reacting to ideas from these groups and other agencies instead of contributing directly to the policy planning process. The JCS received recommendations from these committees at the same time that they were sent to the president. The chiefs gave their responses to the papers not directly to the president, but through the Secretary of Defense. McNamara was anxious to dominate not only the JCS, but also civilian officials during the planning for Vietnam. While the chiefs were denied direct access to the White House, the ad hoc committees solidified interdepartmental relationships between second-level officials and gave them access to the White House staff. John McNaughton enjoyed a particularly close relationship with the National Security Council's assistant to the president for Far Eastern Affairs, Michael Forrestal. Both McNaughton and Forrestal had confidence in the power of their own intellects and felt well qualified to give military advice. McNamara often sat in on the working sessions of second-level officials such as Forrestal and McNaughton to ensure that the results were consistent with graduated pressure. The recommendations of McNaughton's interdepartmental study group were based, therefore, on the same assumptions and premises that underpinned McNamara's blueprint for the war contained in the March memo, which became National Security Action Memorandum 288. On May 25th, the Executive Committee of the National Security Council prepared a memo entitled Basic Recommendations and Projected Course of Action on Southeast Asia, which refined McNamara's earlier memo on graduated pressure. Rusk, McNamara, and Bundy discussed this document with the president during their luncheon on the following day. They recommended that Johnson make a presidential decision that the U.S. will use selected and carefully graduated military force against North Vietnam if there was not sufficient improvement of non-communist prospects in South Vietnam and in Laos. Prior to applying military pressures, the United States would communicate the limited scope of its objectives to Hanoi, China, the Soviet Union, and France. Action against the North would have more deterrent than destructive impact as far as possible and would be accompanied by active diplomatic offensives. The actions would be controlled to prevent the unrolling of a scenario aimed at the use of force as an end in itself. Sensitive to domestic political priorities, the advisor suggested that the president seek a congressional resolution only after crucial civil rights legislation was off the Senate calendar. The president agreed to call a meeting of government officials from Saigon and Washington in Honolulu from June 1st to June 3rd. Taylor, McNamara, and Rusk joined Lodge and Westmoreland, who had recently replaced Harkins, at the Honolulu conference. Westmoreland and Lodge were generally optimistic and believed that the deterioration of the South's stability had leveled off. Westmoreland asserted that, with additional resources, he could turn the situation around. He unveiled a plan for a crash pacification program directed at 8 critical provinces. 3 weeks later, Westmoreland asked for an additional 900 U.S. advisors. By mid-July, he had requested a total of 4,200 additional military personnel. Much of the discussion in Honolulu focused on the desirability of a congressional resolution to validate the administration's policy and on how to influence public opinion about it. Taylor and Westmoreland were already involved in trying to put the best face possible on the American effort. Taylor had met with Hanson Baldwin of the New York Times on May 7th and told him, in contrast to the chief's assessment, that he foresaw no difficulty in holding on in Vietnam until after the election. On May 28th, Ambassador Lodge gave Mac V the task of composing a definitive essay with detailed examples, facts, and figures to support our claim that the Vietnamese are brave, effective fighters willing to sacrifice their lives in defense of their country, which he planned to bring with him to Honolulu. The conference attendees affirmed the basic concept of graduated pressure and agreed to refine plans to support it. There was a persistent lack of consensus, however, over the character of the attacks. The military and civilian planners had not reached a clear understanding of just what should be hit and how thoroughly, and above all, for what objective. The ambiguity was deliberate, and Taylor played a critical role in preserving it. On May 30th, just prior to the Honolulu conference, the JCS met without Taylor present and prepared a memorandum expressing concern over the lack of definition, even a confusion in respect to objectives and courses of action related to each objective for Vietnam. The chiefs, citing their responsibilities as military advisors, argued that the military objective should be to accomplish the destruction of the North Vietnamese will and capabilities to compel North Vietnam to cease providing support to the insurgencies in South Vietnam and Laos. They argued that only courses of action consistent with destroying the will and capability of the enemy would end North Vietnamese support for the insurgency in the South. The memorandum criticized the gradual options under consideration because they were based on a lesser objective of persuading rather than compelling the North Vietnamese to change their policy and terminate their subversive support. The chiefs warned that there was no basis to be hopeful about the situation until and unless North Vietnam is forced to stop supporting the guerrillas in the South. They questioned the idea of using military actions to send messages, which would waste both time and resources. If, however, the United States decided to pursue the lesser objective, the initial action against the North should be designed to convey directly, sharply, even abruptly, that the situation has indeed changed. Sharp initial action was necessary to convey to North Vietnam that the United States was determined. The chiefs rushed to complete the memo before McNamara's departure for Honolulu and urged that their concerns about the planning of the war be considered at the conference. Taylor, however, obstructed their efforts. On June 1st, the director of the Joint Staff, Air Force Lieutenant General David Birkenall, reported to the JCS that just prior to Taylor's departure, the chairman had directed him to withdraw the memo from the Defense Secretary's office. Taylor had told Birkenall that he was unsure that the wording accurately reflected what the chiefs had discussed in their May 30th meeting. LeMay, who had acted as chairman in Taylor's absence, was incensed. Green believed that Taylor's refusal to present the memo to the Secretary of Defense prior to the conference was a deliberate move to put the Joint Chiefs on ice until after the Honolulu meeting. Green thought that Taylor wanted to avoid presenting the views of the Joint Chiefs of Staff at this very important conference. Taylor underestimated JCS resolve, The chiefs met briefly, made several changes in the language of the original document, cabled a revised copy to Honolulu, and requested that Taylor forward it to McNamara. Green demanded that Taylor be notified by phone that these views were of critical importance to the subject of Vietnam, and the chiefs wanted their assessment expressed to the conferees. Separately, Green telephoned the commander of Marine Forces in the Pacific, Lieutenant General Victor Krulak, whom he urged to attend the conference and report back to him so he could check what Taylor actually said during the conference against what the chairman professed his positions to be during JCS meetings. Green's suspicions were well-founded. Despite the chief's urging, Taylor refused to submit their paper to the conferees, and after suppressing the memo, directly opposed the JCS position at the conference. After Honolulu, Taylor finally forwarded the JCS memo to McNamara. He indicated his disagreement with it and promised to respond to it in a separate memo, which he wrote on June 5th. Taylor criticized his colleague's paper for presenting neither an accurate nor a comprehensive expression of the military options available. He argued that, rather than choose between affecting the enemy's will and destroying his capabilities, the president might select one of three patterns of attack on North Vietnam. The first would entail a massive air attack on all significant military targets in North Vietnam to render the enemy incapable of continuing to assist the Viet Cong in Pathet Lao. The second would involve a lesser attack on some significant part of the military target system in North Vietnam to convince the enemy that it is to his interest to desist from aiding the insurgents and obtain his cooperation in calling off the insurgency in South Vietnam and Laos. The third pattern of attack would have the same purpose as the second, but include only demonstrative attacks against limited military targets to show U.S. readiness and intent to escalate the intensity of the attacks to either the second or the first options. Taylor rejected the first because it risked escalation and was unnecessarily destructive. Although he recommended the second option, Taylor observed that the JCS should focus planning efforts on the third because political considerations were likely to incline our responsible civilian officials in that direction. McNamara agreed with Taylor that the JCS options were neither accurate nor complete and preferred the least dangerous third option to demonstrate U.S. willingness to move up the scale if North Vietnam did not reduce insurgent support. Although Taylor attempted to minimize the importance of the Honolulu Conference to the chiefs, he had foiled another attempt to question the validity of the assumptions on which the concept of graduated pressure was based. He told the chiefs on June 3rd that Honolulu was the most overbilled conference he had ever attended, and that it was a disappointment to him. Indeed, Taylor said military options were never really fully discussed. In fact, McNamara's memo on the conference's deliberations, based on the graduated pressure strategy, included a list of illustrative military moves designed to demonstrate the U.S. intention to prevent further communist advances in Laos and South Vietnam. The actions ranged from reconnaissance flights over Laos to military exercises in South Vietnam. While undercutting the JCS ability to influence Vietnam planning, Taylor fostered the false impression that policy deliberations to date had been inconsequential. He thereby bolstered McNamara's and Johnson's effort to keep the chiefs divorced from the policy process while preventing them from openly dissenting. 2 days after his return from Honolulu, Taylor flew to Paris to attend a North Atlantic Treaty Organization conference. While he was in Europe, the situation in Laos became potentially explosive. The United States had begun photo and reconnaissance flights over Laos on May 19th to track the fighting between government forces and Pathet Lao guerrillas on the Plain of Jars. On June 6th, the Pathet Lao shot down a photo reconnaissance jet. The pilot ejected from the aircraft and was quickly captured by Pathet Lao forces. Although the JCS had previously permitted forces in the region to undertake search and rescue operations, Deputy Secretary of Defense Cyrus Vance forbade using U.S. resources to do so. The pilot later escaped and made his way to friendly Lao forces. McNamara met with the Chiefs at 9 o'clock a.m. on June 6th to discuss the implications of the incident for further reconnaissance missions. The Chiefs' failure to make a useful recommendation on what action to take next undercut their ability to influence the decision. LeMay argued for bombing anti-aircraft positions before sending in additional aircraft. McNamara asked him, "How many aircraft would you send?" LeMay answered, "As many as we have." McNamara continued, "How many escorts will be required?" LeMay answered, "Just as many as we have." McNamara could easily dismiss LeMay's curt responses as the ravings of an unsophisticated air power enthusiast. Green, who supported LeMay, observed that he did not impress the SecDef, or Secretary of Defense, with his belligerent and somewhat fumbling way of making recommendations concerning the problem at hand. Wheeler, sensitive to the potential for escalation, agreed with McNamara that the reconnaissance mission should continue and fire only if fired on. McDonald waffled. The divisions made it difficult for the Chiefs to challenge McNamara's position. In Taylor's absence, all the Chiefs, along with Goodpaster, attended a morning National Security Council meeting at the White House. Secretary McNamara began by recommending that aerial reconnaissance be conducted again on the next day with 2 reconnaissance aircraft and 6 to 8 escort jets. Their orders would be to fire only if fired on. LeMay and Green indicated that they personally had recommended an attack on the anti-aircraft position, but concurred in the recommendation of the Joint Chiefs and the Secretary of Defense, even though they were certain that future flights would be in jeopardy. Wheeler gave unqualified support to McNamara's position. The recorder noted that all agreed, and Johnson decided to adopt the unanimous recommendations of his advisors. The next day, June 7th, another escort aircraft was shot down over Laos. The president met with McNamara, McNaughton, Vance, and other civilian officials on June 10th to discuss the second incident and decided to delay further reconnaissance operations in order to avoid escalation. Later in the day, the president's advisors reconvened without him to discuss what public position to take on the downed aircraft. McNamara suggested misleading the press by stating simply that the aircraft had been fired on and returned fire. McGeorge Bundy, contending that it would be imprudent to make an untrue statement, recommended that the administration continue to parry questions with no comment. They agreed that the press furor would be short-lived. Rusk reported happily that there was little congressional interest in the incident. The advisors decided to adopt Bundy's suggestion. At the same time, the president was presented with the opportunity to replace Lodge, who had entered the Republican presidential primary and had just won in New Hampshire. The ambassador was anxious to hit the campaign trail, so the president had to decide very quickly whom to appoint. On June 6th, McGeorge Bundy prepared a list of 6 possible replacements, including himself, Sergeant Shriver, McNamara, and Robert Kennedy. Lyndon Johnson, however, would accept none of these recommendations. He selected Taylor. Before leaving, the general told McNamara that during his service as chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, he had worked hard to attenuate, or if possible, to eliminate the differences, sometimes real, sometimes imaginary, between the civilian and military authorities within the Department of Defense. I hope that our personal relationship, of which I have been very proud, has set an example for those around us and has contributed to proper team play. In closing, let me say what a pleasure it has been to have been associated with you in the last year and 9 months. In my former unhappy days as Chief of Staff of the Army, I cried out for a decisive Secretary of Defense to end the unending conflicts. I got one and am now content. Taylor met for the last time with the Joint Staff on July 2nd. He read an excerpt of National Security Action Memorandum 55 that he had composed for President Kennedy to deliver to the Joint Chiefs of Staff on June 28, 1961. The memorandum had directed the chiefs to provide military advice in the broadest context. He told the officers assembled to maintain this breadth of view and look at all the factors, not just the military. He counseled them to view the problems of national security through the eyes of the president.